Chapter 6. On the misty night of Thursday, the Surprise kept a lookout aloft, and now from the foretopsail yard he called, "On deck there! I think I see 'em."
"Where away?"
asked Jack. "One point on the starboard bow, not above 2 or 3 mile." The ship was under all plain sail, with what inconstant breeze there was, mainly 2 points on her quarter. There was little to be seen ahead from the tops, therefore, so Jack, slinging his night-glass, climbed the taut, dew-damp shrouds to the main cross-trees. He gazed for some time, but nothing did he see until the haze parted, and there, much closer than he had expected, lay a line of 4 ships, exactly spaced, close-hauled on the larboard tack, quite certainly the St. Martin's squadron. On this warm night and in this calm sea, most of their gun ports were open and the light streamed out. He counted the ports, and he had time to see that the 3rd ship in the line was the 18-gun Tartarus, before the mist so blurred them that they were 4 yellow bars, dwindling until they vanished altogether. When they reappeared, all the foremost ports were dark, 8 bells having sounded, and aboard the Tartarus nothing was to be seen but a bright scuttle or two, a cabin port, and the stern lantern. 8 bells struck on the Surprise's battered old bell. He heard the boatswain's mate piping lights out down the hatchway, and he reached the deck as the watch was being mustered.
"Someone has been flogging the glass in Tartarus," he said to Pullings, having given the course. "They're a good 2 or 3 minutes before us."
And as he walked into the cabin,
"Lord Stephen, I'm so very deeply relieved. The squadron is hull up in the northeast, and we shall speak them within the hour."
"I am so glad that your uneasiness is removed," said Stephen, looking up from the score he was correcting. "Now, perhaps you will sit down and eat your supper in peace, unless indeed you choose to wait and invite William Babington and Fanny Ray. Addie has a superb bouillabaisse prepared, and there will be enough for 4, or even 6.
"No. The Council of War must certainly take place aboard the Tartarus."
"Very true. And in any case, some food now would help to calm your spirits. You were in a sad taking, brother. I've rarely known you so impatient."
"Why," said Jack, smiling as he let himself down in his chair, "I believe any commander would have found today quite trying."
He thought of attempting to make Stephen understand some of the difficulties the Surprise had had to contend with, lack of wind for much of the day, and strong contrary currents. The spring tides were near at hand, and in these waters the floods set strongly against her, so that although she seemed to be towing at a fair rate, with all the boats out ahead and the men pulling like heroes, her movement was forward only in relation to the surface, while the whole body of the sea, with the ship and the boats upon it, was in fact gliding backwards in relation to the unseen land for hours on end, while beneath it all, like a groundswell in Jack's mind, was the dread that the Diane, aware of the blockading squadron's true weakness, might have sailed some days ago. Then there was the descending cloud and drizzle, no noon observation, no sight of the coast to check a position that must be exact for the night meeting, nothing but a dead reckoning, horribly complicated by currents and very frequent changes of course, to take advantage of the light and variable airs. In addition to this, there was no real certainty about Babington's course that night. If the Surprise missed the squadron, she would have to look for them inshore the next morning off St. Martin's, in sight of every French sailor, soldier, or civilian possessed of a telescope, thus losing what seemed to him the very great and even perhaps decisive element of surprise. But these were regions into which Stephen could not follow him. No one without a nautical education could understand the refinements of frustration he had had to strive against. No one without an intimate knowledge of the sea could understand the infinity of things that could go wrong in so simple a voyage as this, or the infinite importance of getting them all right. Not that in the present case getting them right and joining the squadron offshore was in itself success, but it was a necessary condition for success. And the relief of having reached at least that stage was something that only another man with so much at stake could fully comprehend. But he was sorry he had let his impatience, his almost choking fury on occasion, be seen, and now, reaching for the decanter of Madeira, he said,
"I tell you what, Stephen, let us eat up our bouillabaisse when we have had a wet, and then, until we hail the Tartarus, we might play your piece."
"Very well," said Maturin, a simple pleasure showing on his usually by no means simple face. "Killick, ahoy! Aho! Let the feast appear as soon as Addy can fry his croutons."
The piece, Stephen's own variations on a theme by Haydn, was correct and fluent, but it was not particularly interesting until the last sheet, where Stephen and Haydn came together in a curious, hesitant phrase whose two beats of silence were singularly moving. The violin played it first, and while the cello was answering, they heard the hail from no great way off.
"The ship ahoy! What ship is that?"
And the full-voiced reply just overheard,
"Surprise!"
The cello made its pause, completed the phrase, and the two combined to work it towards the full close. The door opened, and Pullings stood there with the news. Jack nodded, and they played on to the deeply satisfying end.
"Tartarus is just to windward, sir," said Pullings, when they put down their bows.
"I am most uncommon glad to hear it," said Jack. "Pray let the doctor's skiff be lowered down. Stephen, you will lend me your skiff. And Bondon will pull me over. Killick, my good blue coat."
He took his chart of St. Martin's from the locker and said in an undertone,
"Stephen, should not you come too?"
"I believe not," said Stephen. "I must not advertise the tenuous connection I have with intelligence. Whatever details there may be to be settled in that line, we can arrange between ourselves. But I should like to accompany the attack on this occasion, if it is agreed to be made."
"Welcome aboard again, sir," cried Babington. "Doubly welcome, since I did not look to see you this tide."
"You very nearly did not, neither," said Jack Aubrey. "A needle in a haystack would not bear the comparison on such a thick night. But a stitch in time saves nine, as you know very well, and we set out betimes. Shall we go below?"
In Babington's little cabin he looked quickly round for signs of Fanny Ray, but saw nothing except a piece of sailcloth, with the words, "Heaven preserve our tars," in rather shaky cross-stitch.
"So you were expecting me?" he said.
"Yes, sir. A cutter brought me word from the Admiral that it was possible, wind and weather permitting, that you might appear on the 13th, and I was to cooperate with you in any operation you might contemplate against the Diane, at present lying in St. Martin's."
"She is still lying there, ain't she? She has not sailed?"
"Oh, no, sir. She's lying there against the quay, moored to bollards, head and stern. She does not mean to sail till the dark of the moon, the 13th.
"You are sure of that, William? Of her lying there, I mean?"
"Oh, yes, sir. When we stand inshore of a morning, I often go aloft and look at her. She's had her yards crossed this week and more. And as for the 13th, why, we never interfere with the fishing boats, and there are some that bring us crabs and lobsters and capital soles coming to the blind side at dusk, before we stand off for the night. They know very well what the poor old dolphin is worth, for all her fresh putty and paint and gingerbread work, and just how the camel transport and the vulture slop ship are armed, and they beg us to keep well out in the offing on the 13th and to take no notice, because the Diane is new and fast, and has scantlings like a 40-gun ship, carries heavy metal. Would sink any one of us with a single broadside. Crew admirably well trained with both great guns and small arms. Her tops full of riflemen like those in the Redoubtable who killed Lord Nelson. And in any event, a heavy corvette is going to wait for her off the Cape and see her well clear of soundings in case she should run into Euryalus, due to come up from Jib about the middle of the month. They may exaggerate our fate a little, but I think they speak in real kindness. They were very fond of Fanny, who did most of the talking in French. A splendid accent, very like that of Paris, I'm told."
"Shall I have the pleasure of seeing her this evening?"
"Oh, no, sir. I packed her off by the cutter. I really could not in conscience carry her into action, could I, sir? I remember clearly, though it was at least an age ago, when we were in the Sophie, that the doctor told me there was nothing worse for the female frame than gunfire. I am so sorry he did not come across."
"He thought he might be out of place in a council of war."
"I should have liked to tell you both my good news, but perhaps you would be so kind as to tell him from me."
"I shall be very happy to do so if you will let me know what it is."
"Well, sir, I'm ashamed to mention it before far more important things, but the fact of the matter is, I am to be made post." He laughed from pure happiness, adding, "With seniority from the 1st of next month."
Jack sprang to his feet. A lifetime at sea shielded his head even now from the low beams above it, and grasped Babington's hand.
"Give you joy with all my heart, William," he cried. "I have heard nothing that has given me so much pleasure this many and many a day. May we not drink a glass to your coming flag?"
As they drank it, Babington said, "I know very well it is mostly parliamentary interest. Did you see they made my Uncle Gardiner appear last week? Lord, the ministry must be hard up. Yet even so, it makes me so wonderfully happy. It makes dear Fanny very happy, too."
"I'm sure it does. But do not carry on at that rate about interest. You are a far better seaman and a far better officer than at least half the men on the list.
You are too kind, sir, too kind altogether. But I am not to be prating of my own affairs forever. May I ask you, sir, whether you do contemplate any action against the Diane? And if so, how I may best cooperate with you?
Yes, I certainly do contemplate an action. I've been contemplating it pretty hard for some time. I will tell you the main lines of my plan, and I can speak without any kind of reserve now that you are to be made post. Yet even so, I will say this, William. You are the senior king's officer in this squadron, and if there is anything in my scheme you do not like for your ships or your men, tell me plain. We can settle it between us before the full council.
Very well, sir. But it would be strange indeed if we did not agree.
Jack looked at him affectionately. What Babington said was true, but it was even more wholly true now that he was sure of promotion.
Well now, he began, my idea is to cut her out, all the more so now that you have told me about the corvette that is to meet her off the Cape.
He spread out his chart.
If you have an intelligent master in the squadron, William, get him to check these soundings. They're the only things likely to have changed. Now we anchor the Surprise here, pointing to the south side of Cape Bowhead, with a spring on her cable, and if we can place her just right, when we come to details, you must tell me the exact set of the tides inshore on the 12th.
The 12th, sir?
Yes, I hope that the night before they sail most of the officers will be bowsing up their jibs ashore, which will prevent their being knocked on the head or encouraging their men to any wild extreme.
Brilliant, said Babington, who could conceive of no man spending the night before sailing as far as Margate in any other manner.
If we can place her just right, then, this rise in the land protects her from the fort covering the isthmus. We drop anchor at, say, three-quarters flood. The boats pull off round the cape. They may be challenged at the breakwater. They will probably pass, but if they do not and we hear a musket, we start bombarding the isthmus. Or rather, Tom Pullings does, since I mean to lead the boarding party myself. He does so in any case if I and the boats send up a blue light, meaning we are about to board. He blazes away like smoke and oakum, which will divert the enemy's attention. It was the isthmus that we invaded before. And give the boats time to cut the Diane out, sail her clear of the batteries at the bottom of the bay if the breeze is fair, or tow her if it is not. Indeed, tow her in any event, for this sort of thing must be done quick. By that time the tide should be just on the ebb, which will be a great help. What I should like your squadron to do is to bring the ships in close in case of an emergency, and to provide four boats to help in the towing.
Mayn't we board too?
No, William, at least not in the first assault. The Surprises have been going through all the motions of boarding a frigate twice a night since what seems the beginning of time. They know exactly what to do, each man has his own task, and the presence of other people would only distract them. But of course, if the Dianes prove uncommon awkward, we can always sing out for help.
Babington considered for some moments, looking at his former captain now and then.
"Well, sir," he said, "it seems a capital plan to me, and I certainly cannot suggest any improvements. Should you like me to signal for all captains now?"
"If you please, William. And there is a point I had almost forgot. When you stand in tomorrow, I shall stand farther out. Then tomorrow evening you make a particular point of moving out into the offing very well lit up. When you are far out, I shall slip past you without a glim, taking your boats in tow as I pass. I need hardly say that if any of your lobster boats hears of Surprise being here, we may as well go home, rather than creep in under courses with the hope of finding the Diane unprepared.
I shall look after that, sir.
But discreetly, William, discreetly. Do not treat them unfriendly or wave them away, or they will smoke. There is something amiss.
I shall chatter with them myself and allow no one else to speak.
He went on deck to give orders for the signal, and when he came back, Jack said,
"I remember the doctor talking about women and gunfire. It was off Cape Creus in the last war when we took a French sloop loaded with powder. The master had taken his wife with him, and she was having a baby. The doctor delivered it. Dear me, those were happy days. The Admiral gave us cruise after cruise.
And we took prize after prize. Oh, it was glorious. And then there was the Cacafuego. Do you remember how we Starbolins blacked our faces in the galley and boarded her screeching like boiled cats? Mowat wrote a poem about it."
They were still talking eagerly about the last war when the first of the boats came alongside, followed almost immediately by the others.
"Sir," said Babington, after the sounds of proper reception, the midshipman's announcement, and the procession on the ladder, "Sir, allow me to name Captain Griffiths of the Dolphin, Mr. Lee, Captain of the Camel, and Mr. Stripe of the Vulture.
"Good evening, gentlemen," said Jack, looking at them attentively.
Griffiths was a small, bright-eyed, round-headed, very young commander newly appointed to a very old sloop that should not have been at sea at all. Lee, a tall, elderly, one-armed lieutenant without the least hope for promotion, who was happier in the command of a transport than living ashore with a large family on less than £100 a year. Stripe of the Vulture slop ship was so silent and pale as to be almost non-existent. It was strange to see him wearing the king's uniform.
"Now, gentlemen," said Babington,
and Jack was astonished at the unassuming natural authority with which he spoke, astonished because their conversation had so vividly brought back the little boy of the midshipman's berth in the Sophie, who still had to be told to blow his nose.
"I have orders to cooperate with Mr. Aubrey of the Surprise in an operation he intends to carry out against the Diane. I will beg him to give an outline of his plan for your information, but first I must observe that he and I are in entire agreement as to the general strategy. You will therefore be so good as to listen without comment until he asks for your observations, which will bear only upon such points as currents, soundings, or the enemy's dispositions, on which you may have particular information. Mr. Aubrey, sir, allow me to bring the lamp a little nearer."
Jack described his plan once more, pointing to the various positions on the chart as he did so, and ending,
"If any officer has questions to ask or observations to make, I shall be glad to hear them."
There was a long silence, broken only by the lapping of the sea against the Tartarus's side, until the grizzled lieutenant stood up and, placing his hook on the breakwater, said,
"The only observation I have to make is that at flood and slack water there is a current that sets up against the rampart here. Time and again I've seen small craft fend off from the wall or absolutely graze it as they turn into the harbour. You might think that worth bearing in mind for the boats, sir, if they wish to pass unseen."
"Thank you, sir," said Jack. "That is a most valuable point. Captain Griffiths, did you wish to speak?"
"Only to say that with Captain Babington's permission, I shall be happy to lead the squadron's boats, sir."
Babington instantly said, "Mr. Aubrey and I are agreed that the captains should remain with their commands. The squadron will stand in shortly after the operation begins, and there may be important decisions to make in the event of... if all don't go well."
"Bless you, William," said Jack inwardly. "I never knew you were so quick."
And aloud, in answer to the unspoken question that hung there in the cabin,
"Captain Pullings, who accompanies me as a volunteer and who is the most senior King's officer in these waters, will be taking command of the Surprise in my absence. Mr. Stripe, have you a remark?"
"Yes," said Stripe,
and for the first time it became apparent that he was drunk, pale drunk with solitary gin.
"How do we stand for prize money?"
This was said with a particularly knowing, cynical leer, and the others reddened with shame. Jack looked at him coldly and said,
"That is surely selling the bear. That is surely counting your bears."
He hesitated.
"In any case, the question is premature and likely to bring misfortune," he went on. "It will, of course, be dealt with according to the custom of the sea. Those that tow share equally with those that take."
"Fair enough," said Lee. "It was like that in the last war, and in the American war before that."
"And now that we have returned to the subject of boats," Jack continued, "I will be more exact. Captain Babington and I are agreed that the largest belonging to each ship, launch, longboat, or pinnace, would be best. They should be fully manned with spare rowers for a long pull, and the men should be well armed for boarding, though I hope they will not be called upon to do so. They should be equipped with hook ropes and all the necessary tackle, and they would be best commanded by the boatswain or a senior master's mate. Yet even more important, they must be made to understand that silence is absolutely essential. Matting on the thole pins or rollocks, naturally, but above all, no talking, not a word. The boats lie on their oars when I cast them off, and neither move nor speak till they are called in by name, either to tow or help in overcoming resistance. Since they may have to board, they should have white armbands to be put on at the last moment, like the Surprises. The password is Merry Christmas, and the answer, Happy New Year. I think that is all, gentlemen."
He stood up. He had seen far too many meetings of this kind rendered vague and obscure by an interminable discussion of points that had little or nothing to do with the main issue, and it seemed to him better to leave his plan in its simplest form.
Yet when the captains were gone, he sat down with Babington and the master of the Tartarus, checking soundings and bearings and the order of the French ships along the quay. A worthless brig, two gunboats mounting 32-pounders, the Diane, and two fair-sized merchantmen that had recently moved from the bottom of the basin, presumably with the intention of slipping out in her wake. These, together with the shoals to be avoided on leaving the port, they traced in three copies, together with a statement of the successive stages of the operation in the simplest, most unambiguous language they could work out. And when the three were finished, Jack Aubrey said,
"There, I believe we have done all we can. If you will issue these as part of an order, William, and let your captains mull over them all tomorrow, getting them by rote themselves and teaching the boat crews until they are word perfect, you will do me a great service. I shall leave you now and take the ship some way out into the offing. I shall pick up the boats tomorrow on my way in, and if all goes well, I hope to see you about midnight or a little after. But if I don't, William, if I make a cock of it, you must not. I repeat, must not follow me in or let any of your ships do so. If this business drags out long enough for the French to recover their wits and find that the Isthmus is not being invaded after all, they will keep up such a fire on the narrow pass that no ship will get out alive. I have told Tom Pullings the same, and he has agreed."
"Well, sir," said Babington unwillingly, "I shall do what you say, but I wish to God I were going with you." During the short pull back to his ship, Jack studied the sky with the closest attention. Its veils of mist were still just to be made out, but they were dissipating fast, and the high sky was almost clear, with a few streaks of lofty cirrus moving gently across the stars from the west-southwest.
"I wish it may not turn dirty before morning," he said to Bondon, by way of averting ill fortune.
"Not on your life, sir," said Bondon. "I never seen a prettier night."
Having given the orders that would take the Surprise northwest for a couple of hours, there to stand off and on for the rest of the night, Jack went below. The cabin was lit but empty. Stephen had already gone to bed, leaving some medical notes, three books with their places marked, a half-written score, and, lying next to the magnifying glass, three Naples biscuits, already attacked by rats. Jack tossed the biscuits out of the scuttle, took the glass, and studied his hanging barometer. It had risen a tenth of an inch, and the quicksilver showed a marked convexity, confirming his already set opinion. He opened his desk, where his serial letter to Sophie was still spread out from the day before, and sitting down he wrote,
"My dear, I'm just returned from Tartarus. William is made post. He is so happy about it, and so am I. It is as pretty a night as ever I have seen, with the wind at west-south-west, or a trifle south of it, and a gently rising glass. God bless you, my dear. I'm just about to turn in. It was quite a busy day today, and I hope it will be far busier tomorrow."
With this he lit his hand lantern and went to bed. The lantern hooked into a slot within hand's reach of his cot, and with its slide almost entirely closed it sent out no more than a very soft, narrow beam that lit 2 feet of deckhead. He contemplated this beam for perhaps 2 minutes with an easy mind. It appeared to him that he had done everything that he ought to have done, and that if the weather was kind, he had a fair chance of success tomorrow. The enterprise was perfectly justifiable, even if very much less depended on it. He would have undertaken it in any circumstances. He knew that his colleagues were fallible, that the simplest order could be misunderstood or disobeyed, and that grotesque ill luck could always intervene. But now the dice were thrown, and he must abide by the result. Gazing at the beam, he was dimly aware of the ship's living sound as she moved northeast with a slight following sea. The contented hum of the well-set-up rigging, taut but not too taut. The occasional creak of the wheel, and the complex aroma made up of scrubbed plank, fresh sea breeze, stale bilge water, tarred cordage, paint, and damp sailcloth. By the later part of the forenoon on the 12th, a grey, peaceful day, with a small breeze steady in the west-southwest, the only comfortable place in the Surprise was the mizzen-top. The decks were entirely filled with parties engaged in hoisting up the remaining carronades from the hold and striking down the long guns, and with making all fast in preparation for the night's bombardment. For not only could carronades be fired much faster than long guns, thus making an even greater noise in the aggregate, but only a couple of hands were required to work them as opposed to the great guns team of six or eight. The cabin was taken up by the captain, his officers, and the boat's coxswains, settling a host of details. The medical men had therefore gone aloft quite early, with books, telescopes, and chessmen. There was a draught board, neatly carved in the floor of the top, and on this they had played a not very aggressive game, ending in a draw, and now they were reclining on the folded stunsails. From a scattered body of gulls working slowly against the wind with angled wings, Stephen had picked out what was almost certainly Larus canus, usual enough in the Irish parts of his youth, some of which had been spent in the west, where they nested in quantities on the cliffs and the more lonely strands, but quite rare in these waters. And he was just about to say, "I believe I see a common gull," when Martin asked, "How would you render peripeteia?" "Why, surely, a reverse. But no doubt you mean it in the grammatical sense. Can you not say peripety in English? The French certainly have peripétie, though to be sure they use it loosely in the sense of ordinary vicissitudes."
"I believe I have seen peripety, but it is scarcely current English, and I do not think it would leave Mowat much the wiser."
He passed Stephen a little slim book, Aristotle's Poetica, and said,
"I promised to translate this for him."
"That was benevolent in you."
"It would have been more truly benevolent if I had realized the difficulty, but I did not. I had read it at the university with my tutor, an excellent man, bless him, a scholar, with a great gift for making duller minds understand and even love a text. With his help I did grasp the essence, and I have retained it. But now turning it into an English that is both accurate and tolerably fluent, an English that might be spoken by a Christian, is, I am afraid, a task beyond my powers."
"From what I remember of the book's strange, flitting nature and its many technicalities, it would be beyond mine, too."
"Pride and precipitancy were my undoing. When Mowat told me he meant to write a very ambitious piece called The Sea Officer's Tragedy, based on Captain Aubrey's career, his victories and his misfortunes, I told him I hoped he would make it end happy. 'I cannot possibly do that,' says he, 'since it is a tragedy, it must end in disaster.' I begged his pardon for disagreeing, but I had the support of the greatest authority in the learned world, Aristotle himself, in saying that although tragedy necessarily dealt with the doings of great-minded men or women in a high and serious manner, it by no means necessarily ended unhappily. And I quoted the lines I have ventured to render thus: 'The nature of the tragedy's action has always required that the scope should be as full as can be without obscuring the plot, and that the number of events making a probable or necessary sequence that will change a man's state from unhappiness to happiness, or from happiness to unhappiness, should be the smallest possible,' and desired him to observe that not only was the change from evil to good eminently possible in tragedy, but that Aristotle put it first."
Two bells. The surprise had softened many of the rigours of naval life. No officers or boatswain's mates started the hands into brisker motion with plaited canes or blows from a rope's end. The stowing of hammocks in the nettings each fine morning was not a breakneck race. No one was flogged for being last off the yard, and people walked about in a free and easy fashion, talking or chewing tobacco as they saw fit. But Brahminical cleanliness remained. The watches and their exact relief were still holy, and so was the ceremony of meals. During the later part of the game of chess, quite destroying their concentration, the pandemonium of all hands being piped to dinner had broken out below them, with the banging of mess kids and plates as the salt beef came aft from the galley, and the muffled thunder of blackjacks as the beer came forward from the hatchway butt, for the ship was not yet in grog waters, and the people had to be content with their traditional gallon a day, at twice, which the tradition-loving surprise still served out in leather jugs. And now the drummer at the capstan, no longer a marine but a moderately gifted foremast jack, gave a preliminary thump, and then launched upon his version of roast beef of old England, the equivalent of the officer's dinner bell, the warning that dinner would very soon be on the table. They leapt to their feet, and as they gathered books, papers, chessmen, Stephen said,
"I am so glad to hear what you tell me about Aristotle. I had forgotten those words, or had skipped them. The whole book I read with a cross, superficial mind, having taken against him in those far-off days because of his weak remarks about birds, and for his having brought up that showy brute beast Alexander, as great a public nuisance as our Buonaparte. But of course he was the great learned man of the world."
He lowered himself through the lubber's hole, and as he hung there by his elbows with his feet searching for the shrouds below, he said to himself, "Tonight is perhaps Jack's true peripety. Dear Lord, how I pray that his tragedy may end happy, and that—" Here kindly hands seized his ankles, guiding them to a firm foothold. In the cabin he was shocked to find Jack Aubrey standing waiting for him, unusually tall, grave and stern, dressed in a fine bottle-green coat and a gleaming, newly tied neckcloth.
"Really, Stephen, what a fellow you are," he said. "We are invited to dine in the gun-room, and here you are like something sent aboard from the receiving ship. Padine there, pass the word for Padine."
And to Padine,
"Shave and brush your master directly. Put out his best coat, black satin breeches, silk stockings, silver-buckled shoes. He will be here in 5 minutes."
In 5 minutes he was there, bleeding from 3 small cuts and looking somewhat confused. Jack dabbed at the blood with his handkerchief, twitched Stephen's wig and waistcoat straight, and walked him quickly to the gunroom, where they were welcomed by their hosts as 3 bells struck in the afternoon watch. It so happened that this was the first time the captain of the Surprise had dined as a guest in the gunroom since she became a private man of war. Before the taking of the Spartan and her prizes, the officers had been too poor to invite him, and during the strenuous days in Polcombe Cove there had been no entertainment possible. It was therefore an unusually splendid meal, all the more so since the gunroom cook was determined to outdo Addy. Yet though the table was loaded with such things as lobsters, crayfish, crabs, soles and mussels in 3 separate ways, all corruptly obtained from the Tartarus, there were desperately wide spaces between the diners. Jack had known this table for a great many years, always pretty full and sometimes packed with guests elbow to elbow, but now there were no marine officers, no master, no purser, no chaplain, no guests from the midshipman's berth or from other ships, and he occupied 1 whole side to himself on Pullings's right. On the opposite side sat Stephen and Davidge, while Martin had the foot of the table, and heavy work they made of it, at least to begin with. Jack Aubrey, though acquainted with West and Davidge and aware of their professional competence, had never known them outside the service, and he was not on easy terms with them, nor with any other stranger, for that matter, since his trial. For their part, they found him intimidating, and they too had been strangely damaged by losing their commissions, and with them their livelihood, their future, and much of their identity. Then again, those who were not going on the cutting-out expedition were strongly aware that in a few hours' time the others would be setting off, even more strongly aware than those directly concerned, and they felt that gaiety was out of place. There was tension among those who were going, too, and in Jack Aubrey's case it was a tension he had never known before, although he had seen more action than most sailors of his age. He observed, to his astonishment, that the piece of lobster that he held poised on his fork while he waited for Davidge to finish his period was trembling. He ate it rapidly and continued listening, with inclined head and civil smile, to the wandering tale that was very slowly drawing to its disastrous want of an end. Davidge had travelled in France during the peace. He had wished to dine at a famous eating-house between Lyon and Avignon, but the place was full, and he had been told of another just as good by the cathedral. There he was the only guest, and he entered into conversation with the master of the house. They spoke of this cathedral and other cathedrals, and Davidge observed that at Bourges he had been much struck by the extraordinary beauty of one of the choir boys. The innkeeper, a pederast, had misunderstood him and had made a scarcely veiled proposal. Davidge, however, had managed to decline without offence, and the man had taken it so well that they parted on the best of terms, all payment for the splendid meal being resolutely declined. But Davidge, having at last reached the Rhône by way of innumerable parentheses, suddenly felt that sodomy, as a thing amusing in itself and the justification for any anecdote however long, would not do for his grave, attentive captain, and he tried to give his tale some other turn that would not sound so foolish. A vain attempt from which he was only rescued by the next course, which consisted of soused pig's face, one of Jack's favourite dishes, and a saddle of mutton, the joint being put down for Martin to carve. Martin, a chop-house bachelor until his recent marriage, had never carved a saddle of mutton. He did not carve one now, but with a powerful thrust of his fork, flung it straight into Davidge's lap. It saved Davidge from his predicament at the cost of his breeches.
cheap at the price, he thought, and it was silently passed on to Stephen, who cut it up in the approved surgical manner. It was good mutton, well hung and roasted to a turn, and with it came a truly beautiful claret, a fombrague which so pleased Jacques Aubrey that after the first glass he produced one of the very few remnants of his brief education on dry land.
"Nunc est bibendum," he said with a rather triumphant look at Stephen and Martin, "and upon my honour you could not ask a pleasanter vino to bib."
After this, the dinner party grew easier, though the tension could not be entirely set aside, since two grindstones had been brought up on deck, and their high-pitched scream as the armourer and his mate put a fine edge upon cutlasses and boarding axes necessarily kept the immediate future in mind. Yet even so, the party was not exactly convivial, since it split into two groups. Aubrey and Pullings talking quietly of former shipmates and former voyages, while Stephen and Davidge spoke of the difficulties of remaining alive as an undergraduate at Trinity College in Dublin. Davidge had a cousin there who had been pierced three times, twice by a sword, once by a pistol bullet.
"I am not a quarrelsome man, nor inclined to take offence," said Stephen, "yet I must have been out a score of times in my first year. It is better now, I believe, but it was a desperate place in those days."
"So my cousin said, and when he came to us in England, my father and I gave him some lessons. It was riposte, counter-riposte, parry or tierce all through that summer, but at least he survived."
"You are an eminent swordsman, I find."
"Not I, but my father was, and he did make me at least competent. It was useful to me later on, when I was in a sad way, having left the service, because Angelo employed me for a while in his salle d'armes."
"Indeed? It would oblige me extremely if you would exchange a few passes with me after dinner. I am somewhat out of practice, and it would grieve me to be cut down like a simpleton tonight."
Stephen was not the only man in the surprise with the same notion, and as the dinner party came up to take the air on the quarter-deck, they heard the steady pop-popping of hands right forward, shooting bottles at close range with their pistols, for by now the carronades were all in position, the boats were towing two abreast astern, and arms had been served out. The sea, the breeze, and the sky were much as they had been, gentle, grey, and steady, a timeless kind of day. Jack studied the log-boards, whistling quietly to himself, and then he said to the officer of the watch,
"Mr. West, at 8 bells we will wear, and stand south-east to half-east under easy sail."
After a turn or two he fetched his fighting sword, a heavy cavalry sabre from the cabin, stood swishing it for a while and carried it forward to the armourer for a shaving edge.
"Now, Doctor," said Davidge, "do you choose to have a bout?"
"I should be very happy," said Stephen, throwing his cigar butt into the sea, where it gave a momentary hiss.
"These are Angelo's particular patented pride," said Davidge, when they were ready, with their coats folded on the capstan and their neckerchiefs loosed. "They fasten over the point, doing it no harm, so that you can use your real sword. Far, far better than any form of button."
"Glory be," said Stephen.
They saluted and stood poised for a moment, with minute, scarcely perceptible, threatening movements of point or wrist. Then Stephen, tapping twice with his foot like a torero, flew straight at Davidge with inconceivable ferocity. Davidge parried, and they whirled about one another, their swords clashing now high, now low, their bodies now almost touching, now at double arm's length.
"Hold hard!" cried Stephen, leaping back and raising his hand. "My breeches band is destroyed. Martin, pray do up the buckle, will you now?"
The buckle made fast, they saluted again, and again after the reptilian stillness, Stephen leapt in, crying, "Ha! Ha!" It was the same parry, the same whirling and clashing, with swords darting so fast that only the swordsmen could follow them, the same stamping feet and heavy gasping breath as they lunged, the same extraordinary agility. But then came a check in the rhythm, a subtle flaw, and there was Davidge's sword in the hammock netting. He stared at his empty hand for a moment, deeply shocked. But quickly, in the general cheering, he put what face he could upon it and cried,
"Well done, well done! I am a dead man. One more of your corpses, no doubt."
Then, having recovered his sword and found that it was unhurt, he said,
"May I look at yours?"
Stephen passed it. Davidge turned it about and weighed it and looked closely at its guard and grip.
"A springquillon?" he asked. "Just so. I catch my opponent's blade here. The whole thing is a matter of timing and leverage.
It is a murderous weapon.
After all, swords are for killing. But I thank you very heartily, sir, for this exercise. You are complaisance in person.
8 bells struck. At once there was the cry, "All hands wear ship!" And the surprise began the long, smooth turn that brought her head to southeast to half-east, and she travelling smoothly towards the point where her course would intersect that of Babington's squadron standing out to sea. The sun would set in the last dog watch, and everyone knew that this was the last leg before they stepped into the boats for the long pull round Cape Bowhead. Although some of the younger top men, little more than boys, skylarked in the upper rigging, following my leader from truck to truck and back by the cross-trees to the jib-boom strap, the atmosphere aboard was grave. Jack and Stephen both made the arrangements usual before action and gave the documents to Pullings. All the officers in the ship had done this quite often. It was a matter of course before battle. And yet today it seemed something more than a conscientious precaution, more than a formal bow towards fate. The bells followed one another. The sun sank until it was below the foreyard. Hands were piped to supper.
"At least everything does not have to be struck down into the hold," said Stephen to himself, fixing a score in Diana's music stand writing desk.
He swept some deep, harsh chords that made the stern windows rattle, and then began feeling his way through a piece new to him, a Duport sonata. He was still in the andante, his nose almost touching the score, when Jack came in and said,
"Why, Stephen, you're sitting in the dark. You will ruin your eyes if you go on like that. Killick, Killick there! Bear a hand and strike a light."
"The sun has set, I do suppose."
"It will do so from time to time, they tell me. The breeze has freshened, and we are under staysails alone."
"Is that a good thing?"
"It means that if any busy fellow wandering about on Cape Bowhead in the middle of the night should chance to see us looming faintly in the darkness, he will take us for some little fore-and-aft affair of no consequence. I'm going to shift my clothes."
"Perhaps I should do the same. I must certainly attend to the revolving pistol Duhamel gave me, a most deadly weapon, too. I grieve for poor Duhamel still, a man of such amiable parts. By God, I had almost forgotten this," he cried, clapping his hand to his breeches pocket. He hurried down to Pullings's cabin and said, "Tom, pray attach this to the little packet I gave you, if God forbid you have to deliver it. And pray take great care of it for the now, never out of your pocket at all. It is a prodigious great jewel of a thing."
"I will keep it here in my fob," said Pullings, "but I'm sure you will have it back before morning."
"I hope so, honey, I hope so indeed. Tell me now, what would it be proper to wear on such an occasion?"
"Hessian boots, loose pantaloons, a stout frieze jacket, sword belt, and a line round your middle for pistols."
"Oh, Lord, Doctor, how I wish I were going with you!"
Back in his own cabin, Stephen turned over his meagre wardrobe for the nearest equivalents that he could find, with only moderate success. He also, but in this case with greater success, turned over the question of whether the present conjuncture allowed him to depart from his rule and take an extra dose, not indeed as a soporific, very far from it, but as a means of doing away with illogical, purely instinctive uneasiness, and thus of enabling his mind to deal more freely with any contingencies that might arise in the new situation. If instead of his tincture he had those blessed coca leaves he had encountered in South America, there would have been no possible doubt. They unquestionably stimulated the entire system, bracing the sinews and tautening the nerves, whereas it had to be admitted that the tincture had a tendency, a very slight tendency, to induce a more contemplative frame of mind. But he had eaten, or rather chewed, all his coca leaves long since, and there remained the fact that in emergencies the tincture had always answered. Its virtues far outweighed its slight disadvantages, and in any event the external stimulation that this kind of encounter must necessarily produce would more than counteract any very trifling degree of narcosis. The Diane's destination made it certain that she would have an important agent aboard. It was of the first consequence that he should be taken. To omit any step that might increase the chances of doing so would be wrong indeed. Nothing was weaker than supposing a necessary contradiction between duty and inclination. He finished his glass of laudanum with pleasure, though without the fullest satisfaction, and sat down to the exact, methodical loading of his revolving pistol, while Killick and his mates fussed about the great cabin shipping deadlights. By the time he came on deck it was quite dark.
To the southeast, the squadron could be seen standing out to sea, stern lanterns and gun ports brilliant, in line ahead on the starboard tack. And beyond the ships, well beyond them, the steadily repeated flash of the bowhead light. All the officers were on the quarterdeck, silently gazing at the ships. Jack stood by the windward rail, alone, with his hands behind his back, swaying to counteract the pitch and roll. There was no gleam aboard apart from the binnacle glow, and there was not much from the sky, the old moon in her last day having set, and the haze obscuring all but the brightest stars, and they a mere blur. An uncommonly dark night. Although the shore was still a great way off, it seemed natural for those few who spoke to do so in undertones. Killick's disagreeable nasal voice could be heard wrangling with the captain's cook far down in the bowels of the ship.
"Just you make your fucking patty now, like I said, mate, and I will make my toasted cheese last minute while you beat up a egg in my cellar. The doctor said he was to be preserved from what we call the falling damps, but he won't come down before we've picked up the boats."
Killick was right. Nothing but the Day of Judgment would have moved Jack Aubrey from the rail before he had the squadron's boats in tow. From time to time he called, "Look out afore there!" to the man in the crosstrees, and once the man hailed the deck, "I think I see a light go down the side of Tartarus." Half an hour passed, the line of ships coming closer, closer, until Jack, filling his lungs, called,
"Tartarus, ahoy!"
"Surprise!" came the answer. "Boats will cast off directly and pull southwest. Will you show a glim?"
Jack opened his dark lantern for a moment, and he heard the order,
"Boats away!"
And then, as they passed on opposite tacks, another voice, Babington's,
"God bless you, sir."
The squadron carried straight on, and presently lanterns, shaded from the still distant coast, could be seen in the boats. Low, urgent cries, as the boatkeepers in the Surprise's train of six made the newcomers fast, and Jack called over the taffrail,
"Boat commanders, come aboard."
With his eyes so accustomed to the dark, he could see them quite well by the reflected light from the compass. A brawny master's mate of about 30 from the Tartarus, and the boatswains of the other three, thoroughly experienced seamen of the kind he knew and esteemed. They named their ships and the number of men embarked. From their answers to his questions, it was clear that they understood what they were there to do, and from the look of them, there was a fairly strong probability that they would do it.
"Did all hands have a good supper before leaving the ship?" he asked. "If not, they could be fed here. In such a business, a full belly is half the battle."
"Oh, yes, sir,"
they said. Fresh pork had been served out, and in the Tartarus, figgy dowdy.
"Now, sir, if you please," said Killick's querulous, hard-used voice just behind him, "your patty is ready, and the toasted cheese will go to ruin if not ate up hot."
Jack considered the distant shore, nodded, and walked below. Stephen was already there, sitting by the light of a single candle.
"This is not unlike being on a stage and waiting for the curtain to go up," he observed. "I wonder whether actors have the same sense of distorted time, a present that advances, to be sure, but only like the shadow on a dial, imperceptibly, and even then it may go back."
"Perhaps they do," said Jack. "They tell me that stage feasts are all made of cardboard. Cardboard sausages, cardboard legs of mutton, cardboard ham, cardboard goblets they make believe to drink in. By God, Stephen, this is the most famous Strasbourg pie. Have you had any?"
"I have not."
"Let me give you a piece."
Ordinarily, opium so cut Stephen's appetite that after a considerable dose he took little pleasure in meals, but this time he said,
"It is uncommonly good,"
and passed his plate for more. Then came the toasted cheese, and with it they shared a bottle of Hermitage. They were both very fond of wine, and they both knew that this might be the last bottle they would drink. If that should prove the case, then at least it would be a noble close, for it was a fine, great, generous wine in the prime of life, one that could stand being tossed about at sea. They drank it slowly, not saying much, but sitting there in a companionable silence in the candlelight while the ship moved steadily inshore. Bells had not been struck this last hour and more, but Jack heard the wheel being relieved at the end of the spell. He finished his glass, and with the wine still savouring in his gullet, brought out an azimuth compass of his own design. He said to Stephen,
"I'm going to take our bearings."
Far astern, the squadron could still be seen. though by now it was much more subdued, lights out having sounded very soon after their meeting, and right ahead the tall Cape Bowhead loomed up, a blacker blackness some 3 miles away. Every 2 minutes the headland vanished as the beam from the lighthouse came to the full, blinding the observer. But when it had passed away, there was time for night vision to return, and for the speckling of lights on shore to be made out, together with something of the shape of the coast north-northeast of Cape Bowhead. Presently the white line of surf would show all along, especially at the foot of the headland, for there was a considerable swell, and now the tide was on the make. He knew the lie of the land very well, having an excellent visual memory, and having gone over and over his chart. And he knew that in half an hour he would be able to shape his course for the anchorage he had in mind, the good holding ground quite close in where the frigate would be sheltered from the fire of the guns that protected the vulnerable isthmus.
"Mr. Pullings,"
he asked in the silence,
"is the anchor a cockbill?"
"Yes, sir, with a spring from right aft."
"Then let it be lowered inch by inch to the hawse hole. Then we can let it go without a splash. I'm going to look at the boats."
He gave the quartermaster his compass and walked aft. He was as much at home in the Surprise as he was at Ash Grove, perhaps more so, and he went over the taffrail and down the stern ladder without a thought. He made his way along the train of boats to the Tartarus's launch.
"What cheer, Tartarus's?"
he said in a low voice.
"What cheer, sir?"
they all replied, quite as softly. He felt their muffled thole pins and said,
"Good, very good. Now we shall be putting off presently, so remember, not a word, not a word, and pull soft. When you are cast off, lie on your oars, put on your armbands, and be ready to stretch out like heroes when I hail. But not a moment before."
"Ready, are you ready, sir?"
they murmured. The dolphins, the camels, and the vultures had the same greeting, the same message, and they too seemed deeply impressed with the need for silence. When he was aboard again, he began to take his bearings. He could see the surf now, and with a flap of his hat shielding his eyes, the travelling beam of the light was a great help. He stood at the conn, giving quiet directions to the helmsman, and as the lines of bearing came true he reduced her spread of canvas, so that she ghosted in on the tide of flood with no more than for topmast and main staysails, the gentle wind abaft her starboard beam. In dead silence they passed under the tall lighthouse cliff so close inshore that they were on the very edge of the breakers, so close that men held their breath. And even when they were past the bulge of the headland, they had the steady beat of surf within pistol shot to larboard. Now they were under the shadow of the cliff, and even the dispersed light of the beam did not reach them, but it did light the hill, the vital shielding hill this side of the fort. He started the sheets and murmured,
"Stand by to let go."
The Surprise drifted on with the tide. Again the beam swept round and lit the hill. She was exactly where he wanted her, and he said,
"Let go there,"
quite loud. The anchor plunged silently into 18-fathom water. They veered away in a fair scope of cable with half-words and gestures, and then, the anchor having gripped, they heaved upon the spring until her broadside bore on the isthmus, where several lights were to be seen, the most southerly parts of the town. Jack looked at his watch by the light of the binnacle, and said,
"Blue Cutter's crew away."
They had been gathered on the starboard gangway this half hour, and they filed by him with the boatswain. Then the Red Cutter from the larboard gangway with the gunner. After them, from alternate gangways, the pinnace with Davidge, the gig with West, the jolly boat with Beatty the carpenter, and lastly his own launch's men. As Bondon passed, Jack took him by the arm, and said in a low voice,
"Keep very close to the doctor when we board."
Then he went below, where Stephen was playing chess with Martin by the glittering candle, with his sword on the table in front of him.
"Will you come with me?"
said Jack.
"We are on our way."
Stephen stood up, smiling, and put his sword belt over his shoulder. Martin fastened it behind, an expression of very great concern upon his face. Jack led the way up to the quarter-deck, aft to the taffrail, where Pullings and Martin followed to wish them Godspeed, and over onto the stern ladder. The boats had already formed in the long, linked line that the captain's launch was to lead, and as Jack reached it, the last of the cutting-out party, Bondon, shoved off, and Jack murmured,
"Give way."
At first they had to row against the tide, the swell, and the moderate breeze, but zeal made nothing of it for the first 3/4 of an hour. By this time they were off the point of Bowhead, well clear of the breakers, pulling strongly with an even stroke, never a creak from rollock or pin, never a sound but a strangled cough. From Bowhead, Jack looked out to sea. No squadron. Babington would be moving quietly in. Along the face of the cape, and even more when they bore eastwards, the tide was with them. Jack checked their speed, which was growing impetuous, and passed the word back down the line to change rowers. Another 20 minutes and the far side of the port was beginning to open, with a fair glow of light over it. It increased quite fast, and now the whole northern side, the well-lit bottom of the bay, and, of infinitely greater consequence, the breakwater could be seen. Nearer. Nearer. Rowing soft. And round the breakwater a small light, bobbing about and closing with them fast. Perhaps it was only a fishing boat going out for the night. Jack opened his dark lantern.
"Ohé! Du bateau!"
called the boat.
"Ohé!"
replied Stephen, Jack's hand on his shoulder.
"La bien! Où est-ce qu'il se trouve à présent? Ah, que toujours, nom de Dieu! T'es Guillaume?"
"Non, Étienne."
"Bon, je m'en vais. Qu'est-ce que tu as là?"
"Des galériens."
"Ah, les bougres! Bon, au plaisir, eh?"
"Au plaisir! Et je te souhaite merde, eh?"
They pulled on, their stroke a little less steady, and now the breakwater, with lights shining from the embrasures of its rampart, at the landward end, was full in view, and there was clearly a party going on in the rampart, singing, laughter, music of a sort. Jack took the tiller from Bondon's hand. He felt the current. The ebb had just begun, and he bore over, giving the breakwater as wide a berth as he dared for the sandbank on the other side. No challenge for the launch. No challenge for the next boat. No challenge for the third. No challenge at all. They were through, into the port. Perhaps into the trap. And speaking quite distinctly over the laughter from the rampart, Jack said to Bondon,
"Stand by with the blue light."
He was himself standing up, and in the suffused glow he could make out something of the quay, with the shipping moored along it. Quietly they moved a little closer, and it was almost clear. A brig, some other craft, the Diane, and two merchantmen. Still closer, just paddling now, and the object ahead of the Diane could be seen to be two gunboats now moored abreast.
"Very well," said Jack. "Tartarus, Dolphin, Camel, Vulture, lay on your oars. Bondon, the blue light."
Bondon clapped his glowing tinder to the fuse, and with a wavering flight at first, but then a determined soar, the rocket climbed, climbed, and burst, with a great blue star that floated to leeward together with its own white smoke. Within a second of the burst, the whole southern sky flashed as the Surprise's broadside answered.
"Cast off and stretch out!"
cried Jack, and as the boats leapt into motion, the deep thunder of the carronades reached them, echoing from one side of the port to the other and back again. The boats raced to their posts. As the launch bumped heavily alongside the main chains, an indignant voice called out,
"Mais qu'est-ce qui se passe?"
and a man peered over. But he was instantly overwhelmed by the boarding party that leapt up the side, while the rest of the meagre harbour watch, chatting over the rail with friends on the quay, were swept down the hatchways by parties coming from head and stern. Stephen, followed by Bondon, darted not into the great cabin, but into that where he would have been himself in similar conditions, and here, writing at a table, he found a middle-aged man who looked up with angry astonishment.
"Pin him, Bondon,"
said Stephen, his pistol levelled at the man's head.
"Tie his hands and toss him into a boat. He must not call out, and he must not escape."
Meanwhile, Padine and Darkie Johnson, racing over the brows fore and aft, the gangways to the quay, cut the cables. The topmen laid aloft and loosed the foretopsail, cutting the buntlins and clewlins as they did so. Three boatloads of boarders were sweeping the lower deck clear of the watch below, turning them out of their hammocks and driving them and their girls down into the hold and clapping the hatches shut. And all this while, the Surprise bellowed and thundered like a ship of the line, while in St. Martin's the church bells rang madly, drums beat from a dozen points, trumpets sounded, and lines of torches could be seen hurrying towards the isthmus. The boarders on deck and between decks rounded up the stray Dianes. There were a few scuffles, a pistol shot or so, and herded them down into the hold, where the after hatch was raised to let them pass.
"Mr. Bulkley,"
said Jack, standing by the men appointed to steer,
And Master Gunner, take the cutters and tow her head clear.
The cutter's crews were over the side in a moment, and they carried out a line, pulling splendidly, but their zeal and an unhappy gust in the loosed topsail ran the Diane's stem straight between the two gunboats moored close ahead. Jack raced forward and peered down into the black water.
"Mr. West," he said, "jump down with the party and carry the off-gunboat out into the stream."
"Sir,"
cried West, coming back soaked, gasping, black in the face.
"She's moored with a chain fore and aft."
"Very well,"
said Jack, and he saw that Davidge was next to him and men all along both gangways.
"You two take a boat's cruise and shift those two merchantmen astern. I do not think they will give you much trouble."
Nor did they. But as the ships moved out into the stream, so the scene changed entirely. From a street leading from the hill into the middle of the quay, a group of sailors on horseback, the Diane's officers, followed by her liberty men and a body of soldiers, came pelting along over the cobbles. Jack leaned over the starboard rail and hailed loud and clear.
"Davidge! West! Heave her stern clear and bear a hand! Bear a hand, do you hear me?"
There was no time for more. The Diane still had her bows across, and though she was free aft, her larboard bow was wedged between the gunboats, fast against the quay forward, and the ebb was now wedging her tighter still. The foremost officer leapt his horse clean onto the frigate's quarter-deck, his pistol aimed at the helmsman, but his horse missed its footing and came down. Jack plucked the man clear and hurled him across the deck into the sea. But others followed him, five horses at least, and men on foot were swarming aboard over the brows fore and aft, some hauling on the buntlins and clewlins to take their power from the sails, only to find them cut, while others tore along the gangway to join the very violent, confused struggle on the quarter-deck. There were fallen horses kicking madly and forming a barrier, but as two of them got to their feet, they left room for a singularly furious attack led by the Diane's captain. Jack, wedged against the capstan by the surging crowd, saw Stephen shoot him coolly in the shoulder and pass his sword through his body. Then came a heaving struggle, even closer packed than before, with blows felt but unseen. Surprises from below and from the boats, roaring Merry Christmas and flying into the thick of it with cutlasses and boarding axes. But now there were far more people on the quay. The surprises were outnumbered, and the tide was setting against them. They were being thrust against the wheel and the mizzen and the far rail. Jack had forced his way to the front rank in the centre. Here there was no room for fine work, no room for sword play. It was all furious, short-armed, cutting strokes, swords clashing like a smithy, until a maddened horse dashed between the opposing sides. Through a wider gap, a French soldier, rising from the deck on which he had tripped, slashed upwards with his sabre, catching Jack's leg above the knee. His friends, pushing forwards, trampled the soldier down again, and one of them lunged fast and hard. Jack parried, but a trifle late, and the point ploughed up his forearm. The thrust brought the man within reach, and Jack caught him with his left hand, stunned him with the pommel of his sword, and flung him bodily against his supporters with such force that three of them fell. In the momentary interval he half turned to hail the squadron's boats, and as he turned he felt a blow from behind, like a kick.
"Horse!" he thought,
and filled his lungs to hail, yet now the savage attacking cry of the Diane's and the soldiers changed to a bellowed warning, "Run, run while you can!" It was almost too late. Davidge and West now had a real purchase on the frigate's stern. They heaved, and first the after and then the forward brow left the quay and fell down the ship's side. Some Diane's leapt back before the gap was too wide. Some leapt but fell short. Some fought on with their backs to the taffrail until, hopelessly outnumbered, they threw down their arms. Yet there was still pistol and musket fire from the quay, and Jack, calling out,
"Come on, Place! Come on, Killick!"
ran forward to the forecastle carronades, flintlock pieces, heaved the shotgun round to bear on the soldiers, and though his arm was streaming with blood, he pulled the lanyard. It was only loaded with ball, not the much more deadly case shot, but it shattered the cobbles in the front of a house, scattering the men entirely.
"Now we are here," said Jack, "I'll be damned if we don't take the gunboats too."
As he said this, the battery at the bottom of the harbour came to life at last, but the gunner's aim was impeded by their own vessels, and their shots only ruined the post office and part of the quay. Jack's aim, on the other hand, was perfectly clear.
"Belay there!"
he called to those heaving the stern as the next carronade aft bore full on the mooring bollard. Again he pulled the lanyard, and the gun roared out, its long tongue of fire almost touching the target. When the smoke cleared, there was no bollard to be seen, but the gunboats had swung out with the tide, and the chain, a loop chain, had run clear.
"Mr. Bentley," he said to the carpenter, "take the jolly boat and your men and take care of the gunboats."
The Diane now had way on her. The men on the quarterdeck had cleared the wheel. They had hoisted topsails and forestaysail, and with the tide, the cutter's towing, and the light breeze, she was moving slowly away from the quay. Now at last Jack hailed the waiting Tartaruses, dolphins, camels, and vultures. There were 5 prizes, and he had to get them clear of the port before the French galloped field pieces down to the quay. No field pieces, and they moved out, a solemn procession, though faster and faster as both ebb and breeze increased upon them. A brisk fire of musketry at the narrow pass, soon discouraged by the Diane's full broadside, and they were out in the open sea, heaving on the familiar swell, with the impassive beam of the lighthouse sweeping the air overhead, the Surprise and the ships of the squadron standing in, not a mile away, top lanterns all ablaze.